Okay. So the story we looked at before lunch is this very powerful story of Taliesin, which is a creation story. You have this ancient lake, you have the island in the middle of the lake, we have the two people, and we have the father and the mother, we have the beautiful daughter, the ugly son, we have little Gwion, and we have blind Morda, and then we have this powerful process of interchange between Ceridwen and Taliesin, which is all about the unfolding of capacities and simultaneously going back into the beginning of things. I mean, in that chase between Taliesin and Ceridwen, he gets more and more essentialized, deeper and deeper. So the capacities, in an odd kind of way, the capacities that have come into him as a result of the golden drop become unfolded and dynamized by the chase between Ceridwen and Taliesin. So he has to exercise these capacities. He has to run across the earth, he has to swim into water, he has to leap into the air, and finally he has to become this grain of wheat, fertilizing grain of wheat, and fertilize Ceridwen and grow within her.
This is little Gwion,
yes, who becomes Taliesin through this process. Yes. Right, so then he becomes this different being who has to go through another transition. So he's born, you could say, born of the cauldron, born of Taliesin, born of Ceridwen, and then born out of the immersion in the great sea, that then brings him into the more human world, where he becomes this catalyzing energy, becomes this creative, energizing process that transforms unlucky into lucky, that transforms imprisonment into freedom. And has this capacity to become one with everything and enable truth to be seen. So he takes away false speech. He frees prisoners from imprisonment. And so he, in a way, represents this capacity in our own hearts, that for capacity for continual transformation. And in a way, the story, you know, this is always told, every time I tell this story, it tells itself slightly differently. So you, with these traditional stories, and this is true of all the material we'll be looking at, they have their own life. So you read them again, you see different things in them. You know, and they're intended, it's quite strange in some ways, because they're intended to connect, the images are intended to connect you into places inside yourself. So very often, and certainly some of the Mabinogion stories, have lots of loose ends, because your intent, in your listening to the story carries on with you, and you complete bits of the story for yourself. And one of the central things that we're going to look at is a poem of Taliesin, and there's lots of background information about it in the book, but I just want to talk about it, because there's a whole number of Taliesin poems which we look at over, but this one is probably the key, this is the key poem that includes the heart of Welsh tradition inside it, and leads on to understanding the Mabinogion. So I just want to do an initial talk about it, and we're going to keep on. You'll be sick of this by the time we're done, because I'm going to keep coming back to it. And in John O'Catlin's book, which I've given you, there's lots of background information about it, and in particular, what's great about this book, and why I decided to use it, is that alongside every verse, there is an image painted by a really lovely artist whose name's Meg Falconer, that's right, who paints her pictures in relation to each of the verses of Prithayanun, and it's her vision, her image of what the poem is trying to depict. That's an incredibly concentrated poem with lots and lots of layers of meaning inside it. So I just want to begin looking at it and looking at how we can make use of it to really understand this process of coming down into the deep place. Because what we've been doing this weekend in the experiential exercises is this raid, King Arthur's raid, our version of King Arthur's raid on the other world, going into the mysterious place, going away from the concrete into the mystery inside us, into the deep place called Anun. And in a way, Fern has been asking me earlier about the meaning of Anun and Awen. These two phrases, Anun and or Anuven and Awen, in a way hold everything that we're doing. Because this Prithai Anuven, which means Prithai means the raid or the adventure into or the quest or the despoiling or the taking from. Anuvin, and Anuvin is this word that in Middle Welsh that means the very deep place or the place that is not a place. You could call it the placeless place. You can call it the very deep place. Sometimes referred to as the other world, in contrast to the world that we're in. It's the other side of the mirror or the shadow world behind us or the world within us. And its characteristic is mystery. Now, for the Celts as well, the other world was seen as being very close to this. It's not way up in the sky. It's very nearby. It's in a lake or it's in a stream or it's and just underneath the place that we are. And Awen is this energy of the word Awen has these two components, the letter R, which of course is the first letter, it's the first sound a child makes, first letter of the alphabet, Welsh as well as English, R. And when is this name meaning holy or white or sacred or special? But Awen, the other thing with the letter R in this context, it can also mean it's also a letter of negation. So it could mean the not holy as well. It could mean the ordinary. It could mean the not special. So it's a complex phrase, but it's come to mean that quality of flowing inspiration. Sometimes you could say it's the water that is like fire, or the fire that is like water. And it is this mischievous moving energy that arises out of the deep place, which we are continually trying to cooperate with. And it's kind of a flowing, not fixed. You have to meet it where it is and position yourself within it and let it carry you. It's very associated with the idea of the breath, with movement, with the qualities of life. In the poem, it's hinted at with the image of the cauldron warmed by the breath of the nine maidens. So this is the cauldron of Awen, warmed by the breath of nine maidens. This mysterious image. And nine for the Celts is this, again, it's three times three. Three is often seen as being the number of the goddess, of the feminine principle. So three times three is that power developed to its maximum extent. So it's like infinite breath of the goddess, you could say, that warms the cauldron. And anyway, it's that breath, and it's the finding of that depth inside ourselves and being moved by the breath that comes out of that deep place. So this is this interplay of these two words, Anun, or Anuven, and Awen. And in a way, what we're doing here, and why I've called the foundation the Anuven, or the Anun Foundation, is that we're trying to look at what enables us to find a foundation for ourselves in the deep place. So what happens if we do that? And what light of inspiration, what Awen arises, if we can let us, if we can make the foundation of our being be in the deep place. And so this poem, which is the very earliest ever account of the Grail Quest, if we look at the Arthurian literature, is one of the very early attempts to try and describe the process that happens when we try to do this. I'm going to look at the Welsh and the English because it. So the poem begins, so I'm just going to go through it line by line a bit. We may not get to the end of it today, but we will see. I'm going to keep on going over it.
Can you tell us what page you're on?
Sorry, yes. I'm starting at page 124, okay, which is the Welsh. This is the Welsh-English bit. I'm probably going to flip back to some of the images in the. So I may flip back to the beginning as well, which is 22, page 22 and 20, and because I'm going to look at the images in the book that help us. The problem with it, it's a very concentrated poem, and we need to take time to unfold all the meanings inside it. And Catherine Matthews, who one of the authors of this book, has a lovely image of Prithayan, and she talks about it being like a samurai's sword blade, which is folded tight, that steel, if you're making a samurai sword, one of the reasons it's very sharp is because it's folded and folded and folded and folded. And in a way, the poem is like that. It's so much meaning compressed into it that it is, this, at the end, this very sharp-edged instrument that can cut through things. But what we have to do is to really help ourselves unfold the implicit meaning inside it. So that's partly what I'm going to try and do a little of anyway, just now. So the poem starts off with I praise the sovereign, high prince of the kingly land. Gwelachaf wledig, that's the praising of the sovereign. Penduk Glatri, high prince or chieftain of Glatri. The Glat is, means land, Ri is the word for king. So it begins in a very similar place to the Tree of Life diagram that we looked at yesterday, where we start off with the idea of kingdom and kingship and queenship. So in a certain sense, it's the same. This is the same territory that we looked at yesterday, but using a different idiom, where we begin really from the world of fragmentation and stepping into some sense of sovereignty. So praising or relating to or praying to that which is sovereign in us, and that which enables us to step into or to take our position at the center of the kingly land. Now the kingly land, in a way, if you like, is our life, our world, the world that is ours, the world that we are at the center of. And that, whatever that world looks like, you know, it's not a... I'm looking at medieval things here. We're looking actually literally at the land, the terrain of your own life, the place with the, where you are center. And we're looking also at that place in you that is sovereign. In a way, that kind of deeper place, the place of intuition, the place of centeredness, and making a relationship between our everyday selves and that place. Now this is amplified by the second line, who encompasses the margins of the world, of Ledas of Pennaeth, Dros Traeth Mundi. Now when we step into the place, so when we step into the place of sovereignty, that place of centeredness, that place of taking responsibility for our own world and our relationship with our own world, what we notice then is this experience of encompassing the margins. Traeth is a word related to beach. It's the edge of the world. It's the edge of the island. So that sense of encompassing is that place almost where you stand on the mound and you look at your world, or you stand in the middle of your life and you look at your life. You look at the world that you encompass. In a sense, that's what gets gathered together as we begin this work. You stand in the middle of your life, looking at the margins of your life, looking at the world that you encompass. So it's a bounding somewhere. It's creating it's encircling and creating a sort of a space within which you can work. And in a way, that's quite important. It's important to get a sense of yourself and centeredness in your own life. But it's also really kind of important to get a sense of, well, what is my world? And at one level, we're all deeply interlinked, so the world could be the universe. And that, I suppose, is an ultimate answer to that. But in a more practical, more immediate sense, if we look at, well, okay, if in me here today doing this work, what is it that I encompass? What is the margins of my world? So I'm not going to try and do everything. You know, if my margin is everywhere, I'm immediately responsible for solving the Islamic State, for them all the way, or Ebola, everything in the world. Now, that is too much. Any one human being, you know, dissolves into that. So that those places will touch into the margins of our world and will somewhere sit at some level within our world. But we're not immediately ourselves going to be at the center of those things. So those things aren't deeply into our world. So it's getting a sense of encompassing your world, which of course is not separate from other worlds, but what is it that I encompass and what is it that is presenting itself to me in my world that I now need to pay attention to from the sovereign place?
Just kind of like it that it encompasses the margins, as in it doesn't just stop at the margins.
No.
It actually includes that little bit of stretch.
Yes.
Not ISIS.
Yes.
And not just staying comfortably, but it encompasses that edge of...
Yeah, it's the margin, that edge point, that's right.
But it includes that.
It includes the edge.
A little bit of the unknown.
Yes, it does. Has to. Yes, that's right. Because the image there, you see, is the beach at the edge of the ocean.
A bit of ocean.
Well, where does the ocean... This is the clever bit about this poem, is that the edge is not sharp. Right, there is edge, there is a place where beach and sea come together, but that ebbs and flows. Right, so depending on where the tides are doing, that edge moves in and out. So it's a living, flowing thing. This edge, and sometimes it'll go way out, and sometimes the tides way in, depending on times of year. So the poet is using a really particular, interesting image here. So sometimes the edge is way out, and our field of action is massive. Sometimes it's very close up, but it's a living, flowing process. Then we come to the third line. Be quiet, kachir, guayev, kat, agayev, siddhi. Guayev's captivity in Kaiv Siddhi is resonant or connected to. Troyebastol poich afrideri, with the tale of poich and prideri. Okay. Suddenly, we're immediately in, having encompassed the margins of the world, having entered the place of sovereignty and having connected ourselves to that, we're immediately into this experience of imprisonment. This mysterious figure of Gwaiv, whose captivity in Kaiv Siddhi, which can variously be translated as the castle of the fairies, or the castle of the shining ones, or the castle of the mound. And we're told that this captivity is resonant or connected to the tale of Poich and Prideri. Now, Poich and Prideri are these figures from the Mabinogion, which I'll tell you about in just a second. But what has been tapped into here is a very, very old, very, very old story in Wales, of Mabon and the Modron, of the son and the mother, of the son of light who is stolen and lost and has to be found again. So immediately the poem takes us into the images of imprisonment and the experience of being lost and being found. And that this experience of being lost and being found is resonant or connected to a very, very ancient story. So it may be our story here and now, and what it's trying to say to us, that this experience of whatever experience of captivity and imprisonment you may be experiencing which is uniquely, personally yours, connected to your encompassing of your world and your sense of sovereignty, well, actually, you know what? It's also connected to a very, very ancient story that is known about, which we'll tell you in a moment, but not yet. Right, so again, there's something here about the importance of owning and being with our own sense of captivity and imprisonment and lostness, and not being on our own with that, of somehow being it being understood that this is a known story, although it is also new and fresh and our story, it is also an old story, and maybe the old story can help our story, is one of the implications of it. The story of imprisonment is even more strongly reiterated by the next line, Nebkin noch evnit ith idi. None before him was sent into it. So there's this image of, this is the first prisoner. So again, we're back with the creation story. We're back with the kind of the sort of things once upon a time, long and long ago. Right, so we're with this kind of sense of the primal archetypal imprisonment, of which all other later imprisonments are somehow reflections and echoes of. Into the heavy blue chain that bound the faithful youth. Avgadwin trom las kiraya satketwi. Now the blue chain here is like the chain of the ocean. The image is of he is separated off, bound on an island in the middle of a sea, in the middle of a lake, deep in Anuvan. So we're talking about a part of ourselves, a part of the world that has got very separated off, chained, cut off from the rest of life. So we're looking at the part of ourselves that has got deeply separated off. And there's this beautiful phrase of the faithful youth, Tostachgeni. Tostachgeni is the song of the prisoner. Because of the Veda, so the Arak Prithai Anuvin Tostachgeni, which is the thing that happens next. The faithful youth, Kerasatketwi, makes this song. And he sings because of the raid upon Anuvin. But the raid upon Anuvin is in part to rescue the prisoner. He sings because of the raid. The raid exists because he sings. It's a Welsh version of kind of interdependence. One thing happens, another thing happens. He sings because of the raid. The raid happens because the prisoner sings. Two parts come together. We grow because we're wounded. Maybe we're wounded because of the need to heal. It's like that, right? It's back and forth. It's mysterious. So we're talking right at the beginning about non-linearity. It's not like, right, the prisoner is there, okay, prisoner's singing, now we're going to rescue the prisoner. The prisoner's singing because he's in pain. No, it's not. He's singing because of the raid. And the raid is there because of the prisoner's song. It's very difficult to put this into linear words because it's not linear. Until the world's ending, our poet's prayer shall sound. So we're talking about something that is we're talking about this archetypal imprisonment, this kind of somewhere there is a part of ourselves, part of the world, that is imprisoned in the deepest, that is continually singing, continually praying, continually inviting the raid upon Anuvin. So in a certain sense, we make these 2 days, as we make our raid upon Anuvin, we do that because of the song of the prisoner. But the song of the prisoner only exists because we make the raid upon Anuvan. And as we do this, we're participating in something that is both is simply ourselves, our own life, our own desire. We're here because of that. We're all here because of our own life path and decision to be, a decision to do this. And somewhere we're part of a much older, bigger story that can both support us and enrich us, as even as we struggle with the day-to-day nitty-gritty details of our own part of the story. We are not alone in this work. This work is both individual and personal and profoundly collective. Now then we get this refrain, really. Three ship burdens of Pradwen entered within. Except seven, none rose up from Kaivsidhi, but for seven, none returned from the castle of the mounds. Saith Daraith o Kaivsidhi. Pradwen is the ship of Arthur, it is the vessel. Again, it's got this prefix, of suffix rather, of Wen, which means holiness. It's the holy ship. But this refrain is an interesting thing, because basically three ship burdens, so three ships worth of men go with Arthur into the other world, but only seven come back. Which is a bit alarming, really, given there's 11 of us. Who's the four that ain't coming back? It's, of course, a symbolic thing, but the symbolism is interesting here, because it's about, actually, when you go into the depths, not everything comes back. Things are let go of. Things die in the depths. And seven is one of these symbolic numbers. It's a number of creative. You find it comes up a lot in the Mabinogion. It's in the second branch of the Mabinogion. There's an enormous battle, and where only seven come back from. And the seven are the sort of foundation of a new cycle. So it's a bit like the octave. A new octave emerges. So partly the something goes into the depths, and only seven come back bearing whatever they found in the depths, having freed the prisoner or found the cauldron, and they're the beginning of a new cycle. So one of the experiences, one of the parts of the experiences we get in this work is of it becoming simpler, more concentrated. It's the equivalent of the cauldron boiling everything down to a single drop, all the forms dissolve, and you're left with something essential that is the spark that sets off the new cycle. So the seven that come back represent something new being held that returns with them and creates a whole new movement. And in a way, that first verse holds the whole thing, really. This is the whole kind of process. And the other verses are, in a way, are amplifications or descriptions of what then next happens. So the second verse we get is, I am renowned in fame. The song is heard in Kaiv Pedevram four times revolving. Now, this is one of the things, if you ever read accounts of this poem, what people are always trying to define what the various castles are, because this is like a journey into the underworld through these various Kaivs. The word Kaiv means castle, and people are always seven of them. Actually, there's eight of them, but people always try to line them up with, oh, that must mean the seven chakras, or somebody else thinks of them as being aspects of the endocrine system, and people are always trying to pin down what these castles mean, but they're actually intrinsically kind of mysterious, because what's trying to be depicted here is a process, not things. And this whole thing is there in this image of Kaiv Pedevran, because it is it's the four square castles, so it's this image of squareness and solidity, and yet it's moving in a circle, it's revolving. So it's the equivalent of squaring the circle. So it holds this image of opposites within us. And in particular, it holds, when we go into this mysterious bliss, this strange experience of solidity and movement you get. So when you go into the inner world, sometimes it feels very solid. But it's also got this quality of fluidity. So it is both this four square thing that is in movement. And so what this poem is going on to explain to us now is the sort of experiences you have when you go into the depths to free the prisoner and find the cauldron. So one of the experiences you have is you follow the song down into the depths. And the song of the prisoner, in a way, is quite a dynamic thing. It's the place that's brought you here today. It's that place of quest, searching, feeling the wave. You can't often understand this song. It's something that leads you along. And so this song is heard in Kaiv Pedevran. It takes us into somewhere that feels both solid and in constant sort of movement. And it goes on to say that my original song stems from the cauldron. So this song of the prisoner, the song that we are following, is related to this cauldron that we're also seeking. The two things are one. So the quest for the cauldron, the quest for the grail, is intimately connected to the freeing of the prisoner and the healing of wounds. It is not separate from that. And then it goes on to describe something about this cauldron, which is the cauldron of Pen Anuven, the one who has mastered the otherworld experience. So the possessor of the cauldron is Pen Anuven. So to possess the cauldron, you have for yourselves to become Pen Anuven, connected to the source of the otherworld experience. You have to feel that connection in yourself to the deep roots of inspiration. And to know yourself to be in possession of that is the place where you take your seat in the middle of the other world. You have to know that within me there is this capacity, this infinite capacity of inspiration. And it goes on to describe this cauldron that is kindled by the breath of nine maidens. Now, kindling is an interesting word. Kindling, if you blow on something with a breath, it kindles. It takes fire, it takes life. It's a spark becoming more intense. So the kindling of the cauldron, so not only do we possess this capacity, there's a breath of Awen, which is the breath. Nine maidens, as I said earlier, are the goddess times the goddess almost. It's this deeply feminine potency inside ourselves, which as we unify ourselves with our breath, kindles the cauldron, warms it, brings it to life. So this cauldron, which is the cauldron that Taliesin is stirring, if the fire goes out, it is inert. So it has to be continually kindled by the living breath of the mysterious goddess feminine principle within us and within the world. And then there's this question, what is its power? And then it goes on to describe ridged with enamel. Now, enameling was this magical art to the Celts, where things were made incredibly beautiful. I still really understand enameling myself, but you can imagine it makes things beautiful. So it's brightly coloured. So it's this deep place, this kind of cauldrons in particular, are these kind of heavy, dark, iron kind of things. But this cauldron is ridged with colour. It's like, and you have this image of the multicoloured land. And it's interesting, people have been having experiences of colour and brightness. So in the dark place that you go into, there's also this colour comes out of it. Ridged with enamel. Rimmed with pearl. Now pearl is this translucent, pearls are these magical things that come out of the depths, come out of these little mini cauldrons of oysters. These dark enclosed places that are these shining translucent things that come out of the depths. So again, the poem is trying to say that in this deep dark place, there's multicolours, there are these pearls. And you get this image of pearls of wisdom, or the lost pearl, this beautiful thing that's found in the depths. And pearls are interesting because they're not massive, they're small things. Sometimes called seed, they're described as, you get seed pearls, tiny pearls, that are like little seeds, that have this translucent, reflective beauty. So the imagery that's being used is very kind of precise here somewhere. Trying to describe, the poet's trying to do everything he can to describe the kind of experiences that you have when you come near this place. And the other, then it goes on to say, it will not boil the coward's portion. It is not destiny. So the other thing that suddenly that comes in here is that actually, in order to be in this place, to be the possessor of the cauldron, there is a certain degree of courage necessary, and you have to stick it out in there to let the food get boiled. But only the brave can do this. Only those who can keep themselves, put themselves in the place and stay there. Because that's until the food is cooked. So then the nourishment arises out of the cauldron. Now it's interesting that this is here in this very early poem, because this thing that happens with the Grail story is later on, this strong association with nourishment, where it produces the food, the Grail, when it appears, produces the best food in the world. So there's something, it's also saying that this place is not just, it's quite nitty-gritty, it's very nourishing. As long as you stick it out long enough for the food to boil. The other thing it goes on to say immediately is, it gives us another image. The sword of Chlawak flashes before it, and in the hand of Chlawminak was it wielded. So this, suddenly we're given an image, the sword of Clu or Chlai, who is one of the god figures in the Mabinogion, and is sort of the son of light. So we're suddenly given this image of the sword of light that is wielded in the hand of Chlawminak. Chlawminak means the leaper. And for a while with this very potent feminine image, suddenly we get this very masculine image of the god of light who wields the sword of light, who leaps over obstacles. So it's the sort of the straight energy. So here we've got this image of straightness and circularity. So we've got the circularity, the movement of the cauldron, the movement of Caer Pedefran, and then we've got this, the energy of the sword that flashes through, that cuts through, that leaps over in a single movement. It's funny how these myth patterns repeat themselves. The Superman thing leaps tall buildings in a single bound. It's that image. It's that very well divorced from the ancient Welsh myth, but it's the same image really of the super masculine figure who can just cut through obstacles, solve problems, leap over buildings in a single bound. And so there's something of that energy in here as well. And this is again, you have the masculine and the feminine archetypal energies cooperating together. And we're given, I'll break it just a second, but immediately then it takes us, before Hell's Gate's lights are burning, when with Arthur we went to the Harrowing. Now so we go here with Arthur, who is the great Bear King, who is the great masculine energy, wields the sword Excalibur, wields the sword of light that cuts through everything. So we go into the depths of hell, the depths of the underworld, and the Harrowing of hell is this place where you go into the deep place, and Harrowing is like the plough, and there's a very ancient association with our Arthur is the great bear who also is the plough of the heavens that opens up the earth so that new life can emerge out of it. So it is the ploughing of the underworld to open things up so the new seeds can, the new life can arise. But to do that, we have to go into what can feel like the version of hell. And the lights are burning, the lights are on in hell tonight, so we are expected. It is not a place of sneaking into, we are going right into this place, into the very deep place. place that can feel like hell, that can be a frightening place, but is actually the underworld place where the ancient cauldron can be found and where the seed of life can manifest. And then we find the second line finally ends with, except seven, none rose up from Caerfyrddin, but for seven, none returned from the castle of the perfect ones. So this, or the castle of the hallows, it's sometimes called. It's got various names of Etherwit. So what has been described here is what later on gets to be described as the hallows or the holy things of the Grail, which are, the Grail is this constantly mysterious protean thing that keeps changing, but the hallows are the shapes that arise, so the cup or the cauldron or the sword, sometimes the stone. So we're shown in this place, this, we're given a glimpse of the forms that arise, the holy and empowering forms that arise when we let ourselves be in the deep place and hang out there long enough for the food to get cooked.
Yeah. You mentioned a line that I can't find, except seven numbers up from Caerfyrddin. And then you said something about the perfected ones.
Yes, that's a gloss. It's my gloss on the. It's just a musicality thing. I like to repeat that last line.
Yeah.
In a kind of, and I can't remember what description these of Etherwit here actually.
So we've been in this stanza. We've been to two cares.
Yeah.
So the first is the four square care.
Yes.
And the second is hell.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So go Etherwit.
So Etherwit is hell.
Well, I'm just looking up the meaning of Etherwit in here, because it's got various meanings. A lot of these things don't have very fixed meanings, to be entirely honest with you. So that, and actually, they're in a very obscure version of Welsh. Caerfyrddin, the castle of the perfect ones, is one way of understanding it. It's the castle of the perfect ones that is also hell. And so it's a sort of, I'm just wondering what Catelyn does with that one. Yeah, it's sometimes seen as the fortress of mead feasting or divine intoxication. So it's got this image of a great otherworldly feast where the heroes and the perfected ones are feasting together. It's a bit like the feasting you get in Valhalla. Yeah, it's the same. It's that where the perfect ones are taken off by the Enhavia to Valhalla and have this great feast together. Yeah. And it's interesting, I think. It's great having you here, actually, because it reminds me of the Scandinavian. There are very strong Scandinavian parallels with these poems, because the sacred mead is you find that also in the Norse and Scandinavian myths, and this idea that the perfected ones, the great heroes, the great warriors, they feast in this perfect feasting place that is Caerfyrddin. And here, but it is also the gate to hell, you know. So it's the interesting thing about this poem is that everything has been double-edged. So you've got this great mead feast and the holy things, and also somewhere it brings you to the gate of hell, and to the harrowing of the underworld. So it's kind of quite tricky and interesting because of that.
Mead, in Irish mythology, mead means intoxicated.
Yes, that's right. It does.
Yeah.
Yep.
So why do you think they made it so complicated?
It's because they're trying to describe something that's very double-edged, right? So what he's trying to do in the poem is, one, he's trying to create something that will be transmitted over time, and he's trying to transmit something that is very, very non-linear. So if it was just the feast that wasn't the gate of hell, you. It would be too static, because actually one moment you're at the feast, right? And this is why it's a great description of what actually happens to you. You have when you do this thing, you have this inner experience of perfection, of beauty. Next minute you're in something terrible. And he's trying to say to us there that actually as you go into things are not static. It's all a moving process. You move from the place of perfection and beauty, but maybe the next minute you find yourself at the gate to hell, really scared.
So if I was sitting in the 12th century right now,
yeah,
would this be a language that I would be very aligned to. I'd find it very accessible.
And much more accessible, yeah. Of course, because it's...
But whoever wrote this must have had some sense that in the future some of these images would reside, I think.
Well, yes, and that's why he's written it in the way that he has. It's somewhere... So it's written in a very concentrated way. There's a lot of meaning in here. Because he's also writing this at a time... He's also writing out of an older pagan world within a Christian framework, trying to conceal truths so they don't get eradicated.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. So there's actually there's layers, as in, so that certain people can't access this kind of information.
That's right, that's right.
Like the whole Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, definitely. So that's why we're having to spend time unpacking it. That's why there's so many layers in here. We're going to have to keep on going over and over it. Partly it's designed to help you to get to something and to keep other people out. Right, so that's partly why it's done.
It could be written by a mad person. I'm just thinking of that. You know, when you look back in those eras, because they were also the very wise as well, weren't they? So you've got the duality with whoever wrote it.
Oh, totally, yeah, absolutely. So
it reminds me of art, in that when Picasso depicts his kiss, for example, it doesn't look like a kiss.
No.
But it gives me a feeling of how it is to kiss.
Yes, that's right.
Because it's not actually... You know, kiss could be described, and this is how you put your lips together.
That's right.
But he actually gives me my version of kiss.
Yes.
How I feel it, because it's actually it's a shit drawing of a kiss. But it doesn't look like two very normal people. But it has that power of it because it's a symbol.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
So in the same way, a poem might not be an exact description, but it grabs something deeper, and you give your vibe of it. Does that make sense?
The bit that intrigues me though is, as you know what the translation of this is, why is it, reminds me of being back at school, you know, why is it necessary to go back to the very complicated text?
Because the text holds many more meanings than I understand.
So is the hope that as the participant we will see some of those meanings?
Yes. Yeah, it's because obviously I could just give you my own description of it, right? But I can only give you my own, as far as I understand it, whereas I know there's much more in the poem than even I understand. And every time I do this with a group, I learn a lot more about it, because people see things in it that I don't see. Otherwise, you're right, there'd be no point in doing it. Otherwise, if I completely understood this, I might as well just tell you. Right. But actually, the point is, it is this mysterious, powerful thing. You know, I've been studying it for God knows how many years, probably 30 years, and I keep on finding new things in it, because there's so... And this is true of much of this traditional material. It talks back at you, and it opens you into new things. When I told the Taliesin poem again, I discovered something new again about it when I told you that story, because it talked back at me in a slightly different way. So that's the reason, because any description of it, somewhere whoever wrote this had a very profound understanding, and wrote it in such a way that it keeps on talking back. And so that's the reason for helping you find your own independent relationship to it, and so that it talks back to you in your idiom rather than in mine, really.
We could have a very similar session on any one of half a dozen major modern poets.
Yeah.
Whose stuff I know you love, and I frankly find completely inaccessible. You know, because it's poetry is a condensed form.
Yeah.
You know, that has to be. It's all telescoped down, and you have to unpack it. I'm really interested in the Christian gloss.
Yeah.
On this particularly.
Yeah.
And because you've got this traditional idea of the underworld mixed up
with hell.
The idea of hell.
That's right. Yeah.
And I wonder if you can remind us, please. Christ harrows hell.
Christ harrows hell, yeah.
And what does he do? He takes out, is it the souls that are in purgatory, or the pre-Christian souls?
All the pre-Christian souls are released from hell. It's a sort of interesting thing, because he's done something clever here in terms of protecting the material. Right, because if you were we don't get quite what he's up to here, because we haven't got that medieval mindset. If you were a Christian reading this, he was having to defend his material, he would talk about the imprisoned pre-Christian souls that Christ has brought out of hell.
Yeah.
So he'd be able to gloss it in a completely Christian way.
Yeah.
where he's actually revealing the pre-Christian, more druidic kind of traditions concealed within that Christian gloss.
Of releasing the inspiration from the deep place within.
That's right, that's right, exactly.
Yeah.
But if he's challenged about, is he doing, you know, what's he up to with all this cauldron sort of thing? Well, he's saying, oh, it's a bit like I'm just using old images from the past to talk about our Lord's harrowing of hell. Right? So he's protected there and protects his material. And I think that's true of all this medieval Welsh material. We have to remember that it's not coming directly from a society. It's actually coming from a Christian society. So there are, so there is a Christian gloss put on it sometimes that is interesting to kind of dissect a bit.
Layers of is it obfuscation,
yeah,
the paradox,
yeah,
interlacement,
yeah,
and censorship.
That's right, yeah, very nicely put. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. So we're sort of excavating. What we're hoping to do is clear away the censorship thing and help ourselves engage with paradox and the entrelacement so that we can start to work with that. Now, the other reason for using this and looking at this is once you can get, this also unlocks other texts like it, because it's a method of approaching these older this older material and understanding how to work with it. So when you read another old story, even different from this, you'll get more out of it than you would have got out of before, because you will know how to read it and know how to hang around the images and listen for the paradox and let them unlock themselves.
Which is the science of hermeneutics.
Yeah.
That you look at the little part in the view of the whole, and then the whole in view of the little part, and you go back and forth. And
that's right. Yes.
Stone.
Yeah, it's exactly the Rosetta. Yes, exactly. This is exactly the same thing as we were looking at yesterday in terms of the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, very nice. Yeah. Let's have a quick break for a cup of tea.
Translating this.
No, I'm only fluent in.